This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Welcome back to A Complete History of Manchester United. I'm your host, Wayne Barton, author and producer of several Manchester United books and films, joined by the legendary football writer, Paddy Barclay, author of this, the definitive biography of Sir Matt Busby.
At this point, I should raise a copy of your latest book, soon to be overtaken, True Genius, the super biography of George Best, but I've left it in the sitting room, so I'll just lift another copy of my book. I'll definitely plug one of yours. We're looking at a Sammy McElroy book.
Yeah, and Sammy not yet involved in this journey in United history, but Busby and Best certainly are. As we come to the end of, really, it might be the last time we can plug the Busby one, considering what the subject matter of this episode, which is the 70-71 Manchester United season. If you're watching the video, please give it a like and subscribe. Join in the conversation in the comment section. If you're listening back on the audio podcast, be aware that we were just holding up copies of Paddy's book on Matt Busby. And it's available in all great reputable places and some unreputable places as well, I'm sure.
Some right dives as well, yeah.
Yeah. join in the conversation in the comment section. If you're listening back on the audio podcast, please be sure to subscribe. Give us a review on the platform you're listening on. Right, so the 70-71 season, Will McGuinness is in charge of Manchester United. The pre-season, we talked about the end of the previous season and a stupid, crazy invention by the English FA to introduce playoffs to the semi-final. A third-place playoff for a bronze medal for the FA Cup, losing semi-finalists. This time, it's the Watney Cup, which is effectively, am I right in saying this was the top-scoring team in each of the divisions? I don't know what it was, but there was one of those cups that was like that. The Watney Cup was United faced teams from lower leagues anyway, and really not notable for anything because United lost to the final against Derby County and Derby. But it is notable for the semi-final where United played Hull City, and this game featured the first ever penalty shootout in British football. Paddy, just about that time, United won the shootout, by the way. I think George Best has got the honour of scoring the first ever penalty in a penalty shootout. So talk to me about this, because I mean, we all remember, most people living who watching this podcast or listening back will remember the invention of a penalty shootout, golden goal, silver goal. A penalty shootout introduced into English football is still divisive today, whether or not it's a fair method. Yes. There's definitely a dramatic feel to any penalty shootout. What was the feel of the British public at
the
time?
The feeling at the time was that it was, worth a try. We'd not yet seen the American version. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I went to America, and like a lot of the players who went to America in the 1970s, I mean, we're talking about the 1970-71 season, so it would perhaps be a bit later when the NASL really got underway, and we saw this 25-yard out yard shootout, which was fantastic. And to this day, I would like to see those replace penalties. We are talking 52 years on, 52 seasons on. And you're quite right, it's still divisive. But at the time, there was certainly a feeling that something needed to be tried to provide a football-related end to a football match. There was less and less sort of appetite for the five-match epics, you know, in cups, in which the standard of football tended gradually to deteriorate and the enmity between the sides increased. But no, it was worth a try, particularly in something that was never taken seriously. I mean, Watney was a brand of beer, usually sold in 4-pint cans and consumed in great quantities at student parties, although I was never a student, but I certainly got into the parties. And you had to open the cans with a triangular thing. Anyway, I mean, a lot more pleasure was created by the 4-pint cans, I can promise you, of Watney's than the Watney Cup itself. These tournaments, there was the league and other football authorities. I mean, bear in mind, we're still in the infancy of the League Cup. And there was a feeling that fans wanted trophies. And it was a good theory. To this day, everyone wants a prize in football. Everyone wants success. And there was a feeling that, you know, the greater the number of trophies, the more football would grow. But still, the Watney Cup was not taken terribly seriously. I think in previous episode, we mentioned the Anglo-Italian Cup. That was another. There was also an Anglo-Scottish Cup. Again, an idea that's considered a good one, particularly north of the border, but didn't take off really at all. So it really, of all these trophies, only the League Cup has really thrived to this day.
I would be inclined to replace the League Cup with the Anglo-Scottish Cup. I think it sounds a much better idea. It'd be a lot more interesting.
What I've always yearned to see is the FA Cup invite Scottish clubs, not only Scottish clubs, but clubs from all over the world, including Brazil, as a sort of genuflection to the original FA Cup, which was open to Scottish and Welsh clubs. In fact, I think Queen's Park from Glasgow got to several semi-finals of the League Cup, and of course Welsh clubs have won it. So it wasn't. I still argue that the FA Cup was not only the first knockout tournament; it was the first international football tournament, given that Scotland and Wales are foreign countries in football terms. Yeah, but we digress.
Yeah, United's interests are all domestic in this season, and very inshore as well when it comes to that. They lost the Botany Cup against Derby County in the final, and the league season from day one is a bit of a disaster. We'll talk about the... Because obviously it comes in two parts. The first part is before Christmas and the second is after. Up until Christmas, it is a complete disaster. A 4-0 loss at Ipswich, a 1-0 defeat at home to Palace, a 4-1 defeat at home to Manchester City, a 3-1 defeat at home to Arsenal, a few disciplinary problems within the squad. Really, the idea that Wilfred... Not that he was turning things around at the back end of the previous season, but he'd at least, you know, he'd stabilised. They'd finished in eighth, which was still a minor improvement. They got to the semi-finals.
Yeah.
Why did he... I mean, some of the answers are obvious. The discipline that he had on the squad wasn't quite strong. Firstly, because of his own background and closer relationship with the players, and secondly, because of the feeling that because of Busby's, for want of a better phrase, interference, his involvement. Yes. He never had the full backing of the likes of a Best or a Stepney, who we talked about in the previous episode, or Charlton even. They always knew that Wilf wouldn't have the final say. Is it as simple as that to say that's why things fell apart so badly?
Yes, I think almost as simple as that. Yes, I do think so. I mean, basically, you had now we are talking 1, 2, 3 seasons, 2.5 seasons after the team was the champions of Europe, right? But of those players, you can basically go through the whole 1 to 11, apart from Aston, the hero of the final, who had broken his leg and whose career had taken a knock, you know, in every sense from that. But all of the other, Crerand was aging, 32 now. Stiles, who'd suffered terribly from injury, had gone, been sold to, I think it was Middlesbrough. You can virtually go through it. Dennis Law, although still playing for United, was being injected into his arthritic knee before every game now. So there was but you can go through. Charlton had just been to a World Cup with England, where his substitution by Ramsey was so controversial in Mexico, but. So he was still, of course, having taken a prominent role in a World Cup, it would be ridiculous to say that Charlton was nearing the end. But, all the way through, Foulkes was now on the coaching staff. In fact, at the end of the season we're talking about, Crerand was to join Foulkes on the coaching staff. Yeah. So, you know, basically you went through the team and the only player who should still have been at his peak was a drunk, and that was George Best. So it's still brilliant, but destined never really to sustain this brilliance that had him as arguably the most exciting player in the world. So it was a classic case of a club being allowed to decay. And I think we've mentioned in previous episodes that Busby has to take some responsibility for that. Now, he built this team, but he was too grateful, too kind, too nice in not helping the managers, the other staff members, to dismantle it.
Yeah. Wilf McGuinness... the era of Wilf McGuinness was effectively over when Third Division Villa knocked United out of the League Cup at the semi-final stage before Christmas. So obviously results have an impact on that. United draw 4-4 with Derby County on Boxing Day, a really entertaining game. So Wilf McGuinness is actually surprised the day after when he's called into Busby's office at Old Trafford. I'm going to quote McGuinness's memory of what Busby said to him. Wilf, and by the way, McGuinness says that back in the day, obviously, when he had a more photographic memory, it was very vivid with the way that he could tell stories, apart from, as we've talked about, the memory of that Duncan Edwards goal while him. But generally, his memory for conversations was absolutely fantastic, and he recalled this one. Wilf, the results are not going well. We're halfway through the season, and we're near the bottom of the table. The directors have asked me to take over the team again, which is a straightforward matter of fact way of saying it. McGuinness is not technically sacked. He was offered a job of reserve team coach. McGuinness actually he said, he was like trying to plead his case, saying what he needed and why he thought the results hadn't been going United's way. I don't know how it came out of that conversation concluded, where McGuinness accepted reserve team coach, accepted that he would take that duty for the rest of the season. But he was obviously heartbroken by the decision. He's he was bereft, really. I mean, so much so that the stress made his hair fall out, which, I mean, people have said as a joke and it's become a punchline, but it was the fact. He was absolutely devastated by what had happened. He was charge of the reserve team. Matt Busby resumed control for the foreseeable future. I mean, we'll come to a conversation that was had between Best and Busby later on in regards to how long Busby actually saw
his tenure lasting, but it was very much a case he's going to come in and steady the ship for those final few months. It was never a case he was going to stay for a long time. Immediately, Paddy, Busby had to deal with some George Best misconduct. Now, Best had been, he was in the middle of a, well, he was actually fourth. Suspension was due because he'd been sent off against City in that home defeat for a fall on Glen Poddo where he'd broken his leg. Complete accident. Best had been horrified by it being suspended for it. Before that, he was due to travel with the United squad to Chelsea, but he missed a train. Busby had to read the riot act to him. But it wasn't really a riot act. To give some kind of context for George Best's form as well, he played decent. It's not like he got missing. Like you said, the alcoholic problems were definitely increasing at this moment in time. But he played Chelsea in October in the League Cup, and he scored one of the seminal goals of his career where he somehow evaded the tackle of Chop Harris and rounded Vinetti and scored a really memorable goal. And then this game to Chelsea, which came around 2 months later, he missed the train to that. The excuse is that he tried to get the next train, but he didn't. Busby wasn't going to let him join up with the squad. When they got back to Manchester, they had a meeting, which was basically plastered all over the front pages of the papers, Paddy. And this meeting came out with Busby almost looking like Best was a scolded son who'd been told wrong. In this meeting, nobody ever revealed what had been said between them. There is a story that around the time that George had been informed that he'd got a daughter from an extra marital affair, some fling that he'd had with the wife of a rich man who had no knowledge of this fling, and obviously he was richer than George Best, which he couldn't might not believe at the time. So George was devastated by the fact that he had a daughter that he couldn't see. This was the story. So this was the rumour that Best and Busby discussed and they wouldn't make public. Where was Busby's mind with this? Because, I mean, to walk back in, perhaps wanting to steady the ship for the next 6 months and then to be immediately faced with a problem of this size, must he have already been thinking, I'm really too old for this, I don't want to be involved with this anymore?
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, yes, Busby was only 61 at this time, but he was an old 61, partly because of Munich and the aftermath, all the burdens that he'd carried since then. Yes, he was tired, and he basically, whether he could have solved, it's a bit like saying, would Ferguson have solved the Gascoigne problem? If Ferguson had signed Gascoigne as he wanted, or was it one of Ferguson's lucky breaks that he failed to sign Gascoigne? Yes, Ferguson solved the problem of Cantona, but Gascoigne would have been a much, much more difficult problem to solve. So, we don't know whether Ferguson could have saved Gascoigne, and so it's a bit difficult to say, should Matt Busby have handled his George Best problem differently? I think it would be a harsh person who said anything other than that it was a waste of... Again, I'm straying into, oh, George, how did it all go wrong? I'm straying into that area because George Best is still remembered as one of the greatest players these islands ever produced. So, to describe him as some kind of underachiever is ludicrous. But it is still true that he could have done better. He could have been even greater. But to say Busby could have done this, could have done that, who knows? Certainly one or two former players who passed through that era, I'm thinking in particular of my friend Ian Ewer, felt that Busby should have just bombed George out of the club.
Yeah.
But that would have been such a gamble. Look at Barcelona after Messi, you know. It's so Arsenal after Thierry Henry. It's so difficult to replace someone who is that great a component of your team and around which the team is built.
Yeah, especially at the time when he wasn't the only one. They were having to face that reality with a few other players.
Yes.
And to be fair, I mean, as much as George's drinking was becoming a problem, the actual term of alcoholism, and I don't want to turn this into a lifestyle podcast, but it wasn't really a well-defined term. I think it's probably the late... I did some study of this for the book on George. It was basically the late 60s when, in America, they started to consider alcoholism as a disease. It wasn't... I mean, at the time, drinking was so heavily part of the British football culture that...
Yes.
Just on the terraces, it was part of... I mean, Jimmy Murphy's famous stories of walking around at half-time with a flask of whiskey and giving the players a little shot of it.
And a drink after training was considered almost therapeutic, you know, a good way of replacing fluids. So, yes, completely different era. If you saw a player having a drink after training now, I mean, you'd think this guy's got problems. But in those days, George going to the grapes in Deansgate or wherever, the Brown Bull in Salford, and it was just, hey, George, one of the lads, you know. It wasn't seen as a disease, no.
To actually put it in the contemporary I'm trying to think of the right word for it. It's pretty in the context of the contemporary era, right? So you're in this situation where he's drinking and alcoholism isn't really coined as a disease yet, or even an illness, you know, like it was still probably maybe even the mid-90s before people said, you know, like actually realised it was an illness rather than, you know, it was an addiction.
Rather than a lifestyle choice. Yeah.
But at the time as well, when George was recalled into when he was given this sort of second chance by Busby, the one of the lines in the press was that that Best had agreed to see a psychiatrist, which is such a harsh term. Really, in modern terms, it means counsellor, but at the time, like his head doctor, and even that kind of thing was like it was portraying George in a difficult lie. And I'm not saying that his problems weren't difficult, and obviously, as we get further down the line, they prove very destructive. But at the time, at an earlier stage, where maybe not even a softly approach, but you know what I'm trying to say, harsh way of describing the thing, because you identify someone as a problem, and they're obviously going to, it's a very mentally difficult thing to navigate through. So as difficult as he was lashing out, there are so many different contextual things for what was happening with George. Anyway, away from that lifestyle aspect of this podcast, George came back in from suspension against Spurs again, where he scored another of his famous goals, the lob where it goes over Pat Jennings.
Over Pat Jennings, yes.
No somehow, you watch that, I mean, a lot of people look back at older goals and they say, oh, you know, it's not as aesthetically pleasing as the goals of today, but that is one that stands up. I mean, how do you get it? How do you get a football up and above maybe five players in 6 or 7 yards? It's just genius. It really is genius.
And, you can do it in training, but in a match, you say, you do need genius to do that in a match setting.
Yeah, Busby oversaw a slight upturn form. The era of Busby officially concluded, rather fittingly, really, considering the fact that United had started at Main Road under him. They played at Main Road in the derby. They won 4-3. Best scored twice. In this period, Paddy, I mean, United were already pretty much putting into plan. I think they pretty much identified the man that they wanted to take charge. To succeed Busby. But Best had been in Busby's ear to stay on. Talk to me through the period where
obviously Best and Busby had that conversation. Busby had no inclination to stay on, and then the people who the one major contenders for the job before he settled on the man who would actually succeed him.
Well, the first serious attempt that Busby made was for his friend and contemporary Jock Steen.
Yeah.
Who had won what was in the middle of a nine titles in a row series, and had also guided Celtic to become the first British team to win the European Cup. So, you know, that was an obvious choice. And Steen was interested. In fact, he was tapped up by Paddy Crerand at a match between Celtic and Ajax at Parkhead. After the game, Paddy went up to him and, primed by Matt, said, "Would you be interested?" And Jock said yes, he would be interested in a chat. So there was, after that, there was a FAERS Cup, Europa League as it would be called now, match between Leeds and Liverpool at Anfield. And Jock came down to take that one in. And afterwards, they met in the back of Busby's car at a filling station on the East Lancs Road between Manchester and Liverpool. And there was a sticking point in the discussions. I mean, Steen confirmed that he was interested, but there was a sticking point in the discussions when Busby said, "Listen, I want so-and-so kept. I don't want him sacked. I don't want, I mean, I don't know who they would have been. Probably John Aston, you know, real Man United servants, maybe even Wilf. I don't know. Would Wilf have still been at the club?" Yes, I think he probably would have been. So there would have been sort of sacred cows, maybe Bill Foulkes, who couldn't be sacrificed in order that Jock could bring down his own hand-picked assistants. Now, Jock wasn't keen about that. And he then went back to Glasgow and had a chat with his wife. And whether for that reason, I mean, a lot of people simply said his wife was happy living in Scotland, didn't want to be torn away from her family, and so on. But I think it was more complicated than that. I think it was to do with Jock needing his own team around him and wanting to break up the United backroom, which Matt, mirroring Matt's attitude to the team, "Oh, no, 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 give him another season. Oh, no, 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 you can't sack Paddy Crerand. You can't, you know." They won me the Champions League, you know, the European Cup. Yeah. So it probably, I think that was the main reason that Jock stayed at Celtic. Anyway, he did, much to his wife's relief, because she was happy living in Scotland.
Yeah.
So that was it. So Matt had to turn his thoughts to the succession to other people. Now, I don't know how far we are down the line of this 70-71 season, Wayne, but as listeners to previous episodes will recall, Leicester under Frank O'Farrell had got to an FA Cup final the previous year, got to the FA Cup final, but also been relegated. But Frank O'Farrell, Busby had already liked the look of the cut of Frank O'Farrell's jib. The fact that he was an Irish Catholic would have done no harm, certainly in Matt's eyes. So culturally, he was and a dignified man like Sir Matt. So Matt may have seen a little of himself, his young self, in Frank O'Farrell. And Leicester were steaming back. They were going to be in the Premier League, the First Division, the following season. So that was Matt's next idea, Frank O'Farrell. He's the perfect. And sure enough, at the end of this season, United under Matt have improved, and I'm sure you'll want to tell the story in more detail, but United have improved under Matt after he takes over from Wilf after the 4-4 draw with Derby at Brian Clough's Derby, during which George Best scored twice. The results have improved. from fifth bottom, United were to finish eighth, same as last season under Wilf, which is not bad.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
So, a definite improvement then. But Leicester City, that Matt was keeping an eye on, were, as I say, zooming back into the top flight. And that hardened Matt's view that this might be the next manager of Manchester United, Frank O'Farrell.
Yeah. And also, Malcolm Musgrove, who we should mention, was Frank's assistant.
Yes.
The idea that there was a modern coaching setup, Frank coming from the West Ham school as well, which was... you were mentioned in previous episodes about Leeds and what was happening at Derby. Busby identifying that there was a need for a kind of modern approach, and that's what Frank and Malcolm represented, basically. A different idea.
Malcolm was very much one of the modern coaches, a product of the West Ham Academy. And, you know, if you look around, you can see Leeds under the great thinker, Don Revy, won the Fairs Cup. After the knocking out Liverpool, Chelsea won the European Cup. And who was their manager? Dave Sexton, one of the new breed of coach managers, you know, coaching organization. So, yes, there was a pattern to this. And that, yes, I've drawn the comparison between Frank O'Farrell and Busby in the dignity and so on and the cultural background. But Musgrove sort of ticked the coaching box. The Musgrove-O'Farrell partnership ticked that, you know, modern football, teamwork, coaching. So, yeah, you're quite right to mention the Musgrove factor.
To conclude on the season then with Busby, obviously I'd seen an improvement. There'd been some wins in there. He had, we'll talk about some of the players who came into the squad in a moment, obviously, as we go through that. But he sort of moved away from the players that Wilf brought in, the young players, and he sort of stuck with the senior players really as much as he could for the end of the season. He talked about some of the players that he was, as we know, as we talked about throughout this series, that he was loyal to, that he was loath to see upon the scrap heap, for want of a better phrase. But it was also due to the fact he'd come back out of retirement and overseen this improvement. Was there ever, not from Busby himself, but was there a feeling that Busby was giving it up too soon, considering the improvement that he'd seen?
Yes and no. I think Busby made it very clear that there were to be no more Frank Sinatra-style comebacks. I think the improvement was not so startling as to suggest, hey, Matt's giving up too early. I think I did a calculation once that even if you take their average points per game after Matt took over, you know, in the new year and the end, it would still only have got them into third or fourth. You know, it wasn't the old magic back.
Yeah.
So no, there was a feeling that yes, it was time for change and certainly, well, I can tell you the story of the eventual approach made to Frank O'Farrell. But before that, before you go back to the personnel, is it okay to speak a little bit about the Matt's final match in charge of Manchester United?
Of course, that's why we're here.
Because it was quite eventful. And it was on May the 5th, I think, 1971. And we're better for Matt's final match as manager of Manchester United, the main road, the home of Manchester City, managed by his great friend, Joe Merson. Now, unbeknown to Matt, or the match, by the way, was a terrific 4-3, great game, a Busby football match somehow. It was just, I don't know why, there was this, those who were at the Manchester United-Everton game, only goal scorer of the only goal, Ryan Giggs, in the week after Matt eventually died, I remember being enthralled by the fact that the game was played almost to Matt Busby's recipe. Both teams attacked. It was only 1-0, but both teams attacked. And this game at Main Road was exactly the same. And it finished 4-3 for United, so a measure of restitution for the 4-1 defeat at Old Trafford in the Derby earlier in the season. And a great match, albeit played in a sort of an atmosphere of fear of trouble from the terraces, because this hooliganism was now rife. And so the police surrounding the pitch before the start, looking towards the crowd, and there were mounted police, there was all this kind of stuff, a dark sort of 70s, we would now say, atmosphere about the game. And this was of real concern to the producers of This Is Your Life television program that I hope everybody knows is where you get guests, you surprise a celebrity. Now, Matt had already been on This Is Your Life, but Eamon Andrews and his producers of This Is Your Life has decided for the first time ever they would have a second version of This Is Your Life for one person, and that person was Matt Busby, first person ever. But of course, he couldn't be let into the secret. So the idea was that Joe Mercer would meet Matt in the tunnel before the game. They would walk out together, and Joe would present Matt as with a commemorative clock to mark his years of brilliant management. But at the last minute, the chief of police, looking at all the forebodings of violence and so on, said, no, you can't do that. It could inflame the crowd. And Joe Mercer, knowing that the This Is Your Life producers were having kittens in our program, the point I was going to make was the clock would not actually be handed over by Joe Mercer. It would be handed over by the presenter of the program, Eamon Andrews, who would say, for the second time, This Is Your Life, Matt Busby. So anyway, when the police kiboshed this whole idea that This Is Your Life people were going, oh no, tearing their hair out, and said, Joe, please save the program. So Joe went to the police again. And this is 5 minutes before kickoff. And he went to the police again and he says, listen, please trust me. I've got to present him with this clock. I will take personal responsibility if there's any outbreak of violence in the crowd over this presentation. So the police officer says, okay, but it's on your head if anything happens. Anyway, nothing happened. Eamon Andrews comes out from behind walks out, and Matt they actually recorded the program later at the Piccadilly Hotel in Manchester. But anyway, that was the prelude, great match. And finally, the curtain is down on Matt's career. And all that remains is for United to sign his anointed successor.
Yeah. Let's bring that up then. Let's bring that up. So Farrell was appointed in good time for the thing. And talk through, because obviously even the appointment isn't a straightforward give the manager.
I'm afraid it's not. Once again, of course, everything's done in the back of the car. Chairman Louis Edwards's Rolls Royce is employed, and Matt and Louis go down in the Rolls. Yeah, nice, a nice unobtrusive car for a secret meeting. they go down, they go into a lay-by in Leicestershire, and Frank O'Farrell duly arrives, gets into the back of the Rolls. Now, Matt had already primed Frank that the offer was going to be made and said the salary is 12,000 plus bonuses. Now, Frank later recalled, I was expecting a bit more, you know? 12,000 didn't seem a huge salary. But there we go. He was still going to take the job. Anyway, they get into the back of the Rolls and Matt repeats the offer. Yeah, it's 12,000 plus bonuses, Frank. And Louis says, no, we discussed this, it's 15. So, but O'Farrell realizes that Busby was trying to chisel him out of $3,000. And as O'Farrell was to recall later, he said, from that moment, there was a lack of trust between us. So what a terrible, looking back on it, what a terrible start to the O'Farrell reign, and one from which O'Farrell, Busby and Manchester United never recovered.
No, absolutely. And that's the story to come in the following episode. Let's run through the squad as we often do, well, as we always do, in fact.
Yep.
So I'm going to pop up, in fact, not Tommy on here. In fact, I'll leave Tommy on there for a while. I'll begin with the goalkeepers. Jimmy Rimmer was the first choice goalkeeper at the start of the season with Wilf McGuinness. He made 28 appearances in all competitions, 20 in the league. Alex Stepney came back in after Busby's interim appointment, and he made 22 appearances, all of them in the league. Moving into the fullback positions, Tony Dunn, a veteran now, but still capable of clocking in all the good, big numbers in performances, appearances, I should say, and performances as well, for sure. 42 appearances in all competitions, 35 in the league. Paul Edwards in defence, making 33 appearances in all competitions, 30 in the league. Steve James at the back, 17 appearances, 13 in the league. David Sadler as well in defence, 39 appearances and a single goal in all competitions, 32 appearances in the league. Ian Ewer makes just 17 appearances, 13 of those in the league, an indication of his problems there. Francis Burns, technically the first choice at right back, makes 22 appearances in all competitions, 20 in the league. And then we come on to basically a succession of right backs, which all of the introductions this season, all of the introductory players, all played right back, which really indicates United's struggles. The last of those is actually the man on the screen, Tommy O'Neill, who made his debut at Main Road in Busby's last game. He was a rugby player in his youth and had offers to sign. I think he was born on Merseyside and he had offers to sign for the professional clubs in the area. He decided to pursue a different shaped ball game. Yep. Signed pro terms for United just before they won the European Cup in 1968. He made, obviously, his debut on the last day of the season and made the first of 68 appearances. Another lad who was given a single appearance this season, Ian Donald. His game came in the League Cup against Portsmouth, and it would be almost 2 years until he played his next game. Schoolboy international for Scotland, a fullback, signed as a 16-year-old in 1968. He only really had a short professional career. Looking at his league career, he only played less than 10 games in total. So 10 years after this, in 1980, he was appointed to the board of directors at Aberdeen, and he would eventually become the vice chairman just before Alex Ferguson left, and chairman in 1994. A very different career than a player.
He was the son of Dick Donald, is why he became elevated to the boardroom. Dick Donald was the long time hugely respected chairman of Aberdeen throughout the Ferguson years there, the glorious Ferguson era there, and a man whom Ferguson, you know, absolutely trusted. Indeed, he was the first man to know that Ferguson was interested in going to Manchester United. But again, I digress. But Ian Donald as a player, probably more distinguished looking back on it as a director than a player. But there we go.
Yeah. But yeah, there's the first link, really. The first, not even stronger than tenuous link the Alex Ferguson era. United, which will be a long way away yet, but some bumps to ride through yet, unfortunately.
Yes.
One of the other fullbacks, Willie Watson, another highly rated defender, another fullback, been at the club since 1965. Makes 10 appearances this season after his debut at Blackpool, but all of those games are under Wilf McGuinness. He's one of the victims of the Matt Busby returning. He's not seen again. After Christmas, really. So, a player who's been brought in under McGuinness as he was desperate to try and inject some youth into the side. Final fullback who made his appearance this season was Tony Young. Just one substitute appearance, actually. Made his debut in the 17 when he made his debut, and there was a 4-0 defeat at Ipswich. Young was a right-sided midfielder born in Urbston. He was rated, really, by all of his youth teammates, as would be another Young in episodes to come. He would eventually move into fullback there. He'd play the majority of those 97 appearances. Fairly decently rated player there, making his first appearance for United. Takes us into the midfield. John Aston, recovering after that leg break, but never really winning over the crowd again. 3 goals in 24 appearances this season, 20 appearances in the league. George Best is top scorer with 21 goals in 48 appearances, actually. So, although he does miss a couple of games to suspension, he's still around 18 in 40 in the league. Bobby Charlton, a pretty low goal return this season. 8 goals in 50 appearances, only 5 in 42 in the league. Paddy Querrand, 27 games he's reduced to. Nobby Styles, before he's moved to Middlesbrough, was in 19 appearances, 17 of those in the league. In midfield, John Fitzpatrick plays one of his most successful seasons yet, with 3 in 43, 2 in 35 in the league. On the right wing, Willie Morgan scores 3 goals in 29 appearances in all competitions, 25 of those in the league. Carlos Torre, who's made a decent impression earlier in his career, is marginalised this season with just 2 goals in 8 games, 7 of those in the league. Alan Gowlin, playing mostly midfield this season, scores 8 goals in 22 appearances, 8 in 20 in the league. And up front, Brian Kidd and Dennis Law. Dennis Law reduced to 34 appearances and scores 16 goals, 15 in 28 in the league. And Brian Kidd, 13 in 33 in all competitions, 8 in 25 in the league. Fair to say at this point, Paddy, that Brian Kidd was feeling that he should be more prominent in the Manchester United team than what he was.
Yeah.
Was already beginning to sort of make rumbles about wanting to move away. There'd be news, speculation constant over the next couple of years of him putting in transfer requests because he was desperate to be playing more football. And to be fair, due to the
looking back on it,
shout for that. Tactics, Rimmer and Stepney have put shared goalkeepers due to the fact that one played before Christmas and one played after
The change of manager.
Burns, Edwards, Sadler, and Dunn. But then you've got Yuru who did play a decent number. You've got James who played a decent number as well. I think that's probably the most consistent backline I can put together from that.
Yes.
Creran and Fitzpatrick in the middle, obviously, because they played the most games as well. But Styles, making 19 appearances, does have a decent shout before his United career is unfortunately at an end. And Morgan, Charlton, Kidd, Best, I mean, numbers of appearances speak for themselves, although Aston played his fair share of games as well, but definitely a defined 4-2-4. You'd have Gowling in there instead of Crerand as the season wore on, and that'd be the kind of thing that O'Farrell would be inheriting, basically, would be Gowling and Fitzpatrick in the middle of the park,
growling without the elegance of Creran on the ball, without the tigerish defensive capability of Styles, but he had a decent ability on the ball, and he was quite tall, so, well, very tall, in fact, so he was capable of set pieces defensively, which was obviously something that was valued by Busby in the latter stages and by O'Farrell when he inherited him. So that was United's squad that season. The colours were red, white, and red, as in previous episodes, the all white away trip with red socks and a little bit of a red trim. And the blue, white, and blue away kit remained as well. The United review, as we mentioned in the previous episode, had changed into this 1970s style, very pop art kind of thing with the three big circles in there. And the average attendance down by at least 5,000, 45,028. As mentioned, best top scorer in United finishing eighth in the league again. Key results this season, Paddy, are going to be the two games against Phoenix, obviously. The 4-1 home defeat against City was the beginning of the end for Wilf McGuinness. And then the 4-3 win against City on the final day marked the definite end of the Busby era and achieved in fame fashion. United finished eighth in the league. Elsewhere in football, now, Arsenal won the league. Talk to me about this Arsenal side. In future years, they'd be described as boring Arsenal. Whenever you said Arsenal, you had to put one hand in the air to gesture the offside trap. But they won the league title this season, which is their eighth, which makes them the most successful team in British football history. They won the title in style, winning it at Spurs, and they crowned it with the extra glory, winning the FA Cup final against Liverpool. You've written extensively on Arsenal earlier in their history. How good was this Arsenal team compared to anything in English football?
It was a classic example. Probably if you line up the players, I'm thinking of the lineup that you displayed and talked about 5 minutes ago. And you look at the players, he was good. Francis Burns, you know. Okay, maybe not as big a reputation as Shea Brennan, but because he didn't play in the but good player, held back by injury a little bit. Tony Dunn, of course, great. So you're man for man, Willie Morgan on the wing, you know, George Best on the other side. It was good side. So you look at it in the context, you look at Arsenal, man for man, they weren't that much better. But as a team, and this is the way we've talked before, this is the way football was changing. That was where United were being left behind slightly. That the teamwork of the likes of Leeds United and certainly Arsenal during this season that we're talking about, 70-71, okay, managed by a figurehead, pure figurehead, Bertie Mee, middle-class physiotherapist, but with Don Howe doing the coaching. You know, one of the new breed, along with Sexton, of the great English coaches, are much underrated, by the way, a much underrated generation of coaches.
Yeah.
Reeve, yes, people and his staff were great. And they were given due acknowledgement. But, you know, Sexton and Howe were part of a golden generation of English coaches who, I think, went on to influence the likes of Arrigo Sacchi at Milan. But that, again, I'm digressing terribly. But so you see Arsenal in this context as one of the new teams, the compact teams like Leeds, who never gave you a chance because their organization, their teamwork, the distances between them, you know, the compactness. Manchester United could never get anywhere near that.
Yeah.
Too many flaws in the on and off the field in terms of United's organisation. And that's why, not because the players were not good enough, or by and large, okay, one or two were not quite of the standard, but by and large, it was good players. It was the kind of organisation that the new coaching era could impose on the likes of Leeds and Arsenal, both trophy winners in this season. that made the difference.
Yeah, Spurs have some consolation taking the League Cup. I say consolation, obviously, I'm referring to the fact that they have suffered the indignity of Arsenal winning the league at the round. So Spurs won the League Cup, and pretty much that is it. Chelsea, like you said earlier, when they win the Cup Winners' Cup as well after winning the FA Cup at Old Trafford in the previous season. So a successful season for them too. So yeah, that's it for this episode. We are ushering in Franco Farrell era, an era that both Paddy and I have covered extensively, but we'll be crawling over the minute details of it next time. If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like and subscribe on YouTube, join in the conversation in the comment section, obviously. And if you're listening back on the audio podcast, be sure to subscribe and give a review on the platform you're listening on. We will be back next time.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.